to Ghoulish Tendencies. I'm Gabby.
And I'm Kim, and we are two paranormal investigators who delve into the depths of the famous and not so famous cases
of Moira, ghosts, legends, and lore with a healthy dose of debunking.
Indeed.
Debunking indeed. Guys, thanks so much for understanding with like having to push a week. So we've literally never done that in the 4+ years we've been doing this.
Jeez, which is
bonkers. Yeah, I had to travel to Florida. My dad's not doing so hot, but thank you for understanding. And, you know, I'm glad that we did push because now we have a great story for you from Adventures with Kim when she attempts to do a ghost story or ghost story, ghost tour.
Ghost tour.
And ghost story is in the ghost tour. You get an actual story of not ghosts, but Kim having to do a police report and not knowing how to use her words.
It was my first police report. Okay.
Yay! How exciting.
It was something. So yes, this past weekend I was down at Spooked. I was about to give a ghost tour. It was a small ghost tour. Because you know, this time of year tends to be a little on the slow side. It was Comic-Con this last weekend too. So a lot of people avoid the city if they're not actively engaging in like Comic-Con type.
Understandable
stuff. So I had two people on my tour. And I start the tour in Pioneer Square. It's a Pioneer Square tour. And anyone listening to this who is local to Seattle who has visited Pioneer Square knows exactly what that means. So I'm starting my tour and suddenly this car comes like barreling down the street, followed by a police car, and is then cut off by another police car right in front of it. So it's sandwiched. This car is sandwiched. And this officer jumps out of the car and approaches the vehicle and says, you know, get out of the car. This is already, P.S., more coherent than my police report was. I need this to be known.
So funny.
So the officer is yelling, you know, get out of the car. And listen, I've spent a number of years doing ghost tours in Pioneer Square. If I've learned anything, it's when a cop gets out of a car and approaches another car, you get out of there. So I'm just like, okay, and we're going inside. We're going back inside. We are going inside. And it should be noted that there was two other shootings in Seattle that same evening. So
wonderful.
This was not completely unfounded in terms of wanting to not be outside on the street. Just, you don't know. You know what's going to happen. So we start going inside Spooked and we hear this crunch.
Oh no.
So the balls on this driver plows into the police car
that cut him off,
hits another car that cut him off, and books it.
Oh damn.
So at this point too, you know, my boss is inside just like, what is going on? There's some people there who are there to take the Death Museum tour. They're like, what is going on? The people on my tour are mildly laughing, kind of like I was. So we go out. We're approached by this very, very kind officer who's like, hey, did y'all see what happened? And we were like, yeah, I mean, mostly we mostly heard the part where the car got hit, but yes. And he's like, do you mind hanging out so you can give statements? And we're like, well, this is a ghost tour. So we were going to go like, do that. And he's like, it's a what? Like, it's a ghost tour, sir. And we're pointing to the Spooked in Seattle sign. And he just looks thoroughly confused, but then like, okay. So eventually, like, my first couple stories are in a pretty central location to Spook. So I just was telling the stories there and the guy's supervisor gets there. So I get pulled away to give my statement to this, again, very kind officer who I think was amused by how manic I was. And Gabby, you and I were talking a little bit about this before we got started. Like, as a performer, you kind of, you pull energy, right? You pull on this energy so that you can sustain a 90-minute tour that's you talking. And if you get interrupted in the midst of that energy,
it has nowhere to go.
It has nowhere to go. And so you get a little manic. Also, I don't know anything about cars. We should also put that right out there. So this poor officer is asking me to try to recount what happens. And I'm just like, okay, so this is what happened. This dude was just like booking it down the block. And then this happened. And then this happened. And he's like, okay, slow your roll. can you tell me about the vehicle? It was a car.
It had wheels.
Yes.
And an engine.
What kind of car? Yes. What? A dark one? What type of car? It was a car. So oh, we established God. It was a car. That part, at least, I had down. And this God. Is all being recorded. This is my official police statement, ladies and gentlemen.
I wish we could get a recording of it to play on the podcast. That would be very funny.
I mean, I wonder if you can request your own police statement.
You can put it on our Patreon.
I give the statement and I'm asking the officers, like, what happened? What did the dude do? And he goes, well, we started pursuing him on 3rd and Pine, 3rd and Crime. It was a stolen car.
Oh, shit.
But now this is what I thought was interesting. And I'd kind of forgotten that Washington State now has this law. Once they'd stopped and, you know, officer got out and was like, get out of the car. Because the officer was not in the car when the car was hit, no one was in that car when the car was hit.
Oh.
It's property damage. So he hit two cars, but at that point, it's property damage. And because it's property damage, they were not allowed to pursue him any further because they'd stopped.
Oh, that
remember,
sucks.
They changed the law like a year ago because they're trying to stop some of the chases that happen. So the officer was super cranky about that. And I was like, yeah, that sucks. But then you wouldn't have gotten to have this delightful police statement, huh? Huh?
And he probably was not as excited about that.
Was that part of the police statement?
No. At this point, this was off the record. I was just curious and he was chatty. So we then resumed the tour.
What an eventful evening. That's so funny.
But yeah, that was the first time I'd ever given a police statement. And I feel like I've learned some things for the next time. So I'm all ready. But if listeners at home have given a police statement and they want to share their own experiences... Hopefully more coherent than I was.
Although I'm not mad at hearing the non-coherent ones because that's entertaining. You know, like it's just funny because of how much stuff we research and like police reports we read for like topics.
Yep.
And how like, can you only imagine if this was actually like an actual murder scene and this was the statement.
This is a person with hair
missing an arm, or like, I don't know, like it's a car with wheels.
What a nose.
He had a face. But yeah, it's just, I could see us covering something like this and just losing it, laughing at it. And so I'm just proud of you for putting more comedic content out to the universe. So thank you, Kim.
I hope that whoever has to listen to that, I bring them some joy.
You brought me joy. So, and also the fact that you just transposed the entire interaction and put it on Facebook really brought some sunlight to my my dreary weekend. So thank you for that. Thanks, friend. So for today's topic, I haven't done one in a while because Kim's been holding it down. Thank you, Kim. This one's kind of a different slash fun one, but it's not like the super weird ones I've been covering. I've been off on a tangent of like, let me find the weirdest topics to cover and cover it. This is weird in a different way related to Moida. So today we're going to be talking about Moida, a little true crime moment, but we're going to go way back in time. Okay. And I get really excited. I know you do too, Kim, when we talk about like really, really old stories.
Sure.
And, events that have happened, just mainly because there's not that much stuff to reference. And
that's
it's
true.
Interesting to see how information has been transposed throughout time and whether or not it's accurate, right? Like, and then we can throw some jest into it. And it's less terrible when it's an old case than it
that's
is
true.
When it's a more
we
contemporary
can be, we can
case.
Be a little more removed from it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. And this is definitely going to be one of those. But this is technically kind of a tale of two stories, not just one. One is an unsolved murder from hundreds of years ago, fueled by romance, revenge, and politics. All kinds of good juicy stuff.
I love all these words.
Right. And the other is a modern day criminologist who began mapping medieval crimes to help to better understand how the criminal justice system began and how it evolved throughout time. So that's what caught my attention about this topic the first time, because it's kind of lateral to some of the stuff I'm studying right now.
Okay.
But it actually references research of stuff a long, long, long time ago. So I was like, this is something that you, Kim, will love. And I cannot wait to tell you about it, because I feel like this might be one you don't necessarily know about yet.
Okay.
Unless you already read the article that inspired this, which, you know, just pretend you haven't. And then we're going to be good. So what's great about these two stories is they actually intertwine. And they intertwine when this criminologist began to explore this cold case and eventually helped to come up with some resolutions 686 years later.
Okay.
Which is kind of bonkers. Like, the fact that so much has been advanced with technology in the last, like, I don't know, 20 years because of DNA and all the things that we learn about with crimes that have been unsolved for the last, like, 50 years or plus 50 years. This is, like, 700 years. It's not DNA, but it's records. It's looking into what was kept track of, and it's super interesting.
Okay.
So let's talk about the story first, and then we'll get into our criminologist friend, who I truly just want to talk to. Did not. Would love to. We'll get to that later. So here's the story. On May 3rd, 1337, a priest named John Ford. What a name. Just so boring and unique. He was murdered mafia style. In broad daylight. In the street opposite the Church of St. Michael Le Quern in the ward of Farrington within in London. Now, the coroner and sheriffs filed a report detailing the murder. And there was a mysterious, quote, long-standing dispute that was brought up. Now, this dispute involved a high-ranking and very famous English noblewoman named Ella Fitzpaine. Ella Fitzpaine was born in around 1295 as Ella Nouvelle. She ended up marrying her second husband, Sir Robert Fitzpaine, who was a baron, which the second I saw baron, I was like, yes. It just makes me think automatically what we do in the shadows, the Baron.
Oh, yes.
Not the same.
Not the same.
Great visual. but he was a Baron and the son of the first Baron Fitzpaine. And this family was real well connected politically. They were of the highest ranks of English aristocracy. And, you know, Ella, allegedly had some beef. She had some beef with this guy.
Okay.
This guy was John Ford. And John Ford happened to be a man of the cloth. So he was a priest. So as a noblewoman does, Ella convinces her brother, Hugh Lavelle, two of her servants, Hugh Colne and John Strong, a chaplain, Hascop Nivelle, and a man named John Tyndale to kill him. This just seems so dirty that she's included another like priest-like person in this, which is just like surprising, but that was just my take. Now, some sources say that there's three guys that were involved. Some say four or five. It kind of depends on what your source is.
Okay.
Either way, this is obviously a hired hit, like a medieval mafia hit, which is just go nuts thinking about that. So this is how it all went down. John Ford is walking up Cheapside opposite the junction of Bread Street. And he gets distracted by the priest guy, the chaplain Hascop. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. It's spelled weird. Hascop Nivelle. Okay. And he distracts him, starting up a pleasant conversation with him, which slows him down. Mm-hmm. And he was polite, so he engaged and he starts talking. But the pleasant conversation didn't last very long. So when they get to Foster Lane, which is just up the ways, mm-hmm. Hugh Lavelle and Hugh Colne, hashtag everyone's named Hugh, and John Strong join them. And Hugh Lavelle proceeds to stab John Ford in the throat with an analaz, which is actually a medieval dagger, while Hugh Colne and John Strong stab him in the belly with their long knives. And those would be the fatal blows. The assailants then ran away, but no one really saw where they went. So unfortunately, Ford was abandoned and left to bleed to death under the arches of what was once Greyfriars Church. Mm-hmm. There were only three witnesses. Robert Russell, he was a maker of rosaries, mm-hmm. William Newcomen, and Michael Hatter, who was a hat maker. Sidebar. Love that he was a hat maker, mm-hmm. and his last name was Hatter. It's just chef's kiss. You can't make that up.
That's true.
Apparently they all had their shops like just along that road, which is where the murder happened, which is why they were the witnesses. And the sheriffs were then instructed to arrest the fugitives if they were found within their, vicinity that they could arrest someone within.
Sure.
So it took a while for anything to happen, years actually. And in 1342, the coroner brought an indictment against Hugh Colne, who mm-hmm. was then imprisoned at Newgate. But I couldn't find much about any kind of resolution that has happened outside of that. And overall, like, not much generally happened. And this warm-ish case started to grow cold. They're like, well, what happened? How did this happen? And there wasn't much information available or anything really at least documented or done mm-hmm. with it.
Sure.
And to me, that sounds like some shady shit. Mm. And the question remains, what could John Ford have possibly done, this priest? What could he have done for Ella Fitzpaine to order such an assassination in broad daylight?
Sure.
And was she the one who was actually blamed for this? Did she even get punished for this? Like, mm-hmm. if Hugh Colne got, imprisoned, what happened to her?
Sure.
And was it her even? Did she get set up? Did someone else frame her and like make it seem like it was her, but it was someone else who suggested that this happen? She could have been framed for politics at the time, associated with the wrong people, or maybe pissed off somebody in power within her high society in-laws, Who knows? So Who many knows? Questions. We have so many questions. What else is new, right? So enter someone else besides you, Kim, and me, who had questions and wanted to know what happened and why. Enter criminologist and professor, Dr. Manuel Eisner.
Okay.
So Professor Dr. Manuel Eisner is currently the deputy director of the Cambridge Institute of Criminology. Mm-hmm. And he studied history at the University of Zurich, also holds a PhD in sociology.
Cool.
When I was reading about him, I really just was like, I want to be friends with this guy. This guy sounds awesome. So in his biography, he actually states that this is just kind of a massive quote, but I felt like it was worth sharing. Quote, my academic work revolves around the explanation of the causes, the consequences, and the prevention of interpersonal violence across human societies. My research tries to contribute to the following questions. How can we describe and explain variation in levels of violence between societies and over the course of human history? What psychological and social mechanisms account for change and stability of violent behavior over the life course? What combination of prevention, intervention, and control is best suited to reduce interpersonal violence in different societies across the world? End quote. All great questions, and yeah. Truly would love to pick his brain. So, while Eisner's work has been predominantly focused on contemporary crimes, he started looking into medieval crimes back in 2012.
Okay.
But honestly, the best part of how he began doing this is how he started doing it with his wife, which is like the best story ever.
Love it.
Truly, best date night ideas ever for you, Kim. And also for me, let's be real, like for us, but like separately, like not together. I mean, we could do this together, but that's truly just what this podcast is. So like, so prospective singles, take note for Kim. For a fun night at home, sure. Eisner and his wife would hang out in their kitchen while his wife would read 14th century murder stories out loud. And he would basically create a murder map using an antique map of London and would put pins into the locations of the murders.
I mean, I have one of those, but not for London. It's for another case.
But do you see how this is right up your alley? Like, this is exactly like
making a fun board.
Yes, but a date night activity? Are you kidding me? This sounds like such a great time.
Absolutely.
Good on them. Love that. Love that they found each other and could do this together. Like, chef's kiss, amazing. But what's even better, and like, and I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but I have to share here, is that they have a daughter, and the daughter is basically one of the hosts of the podcast that they created together called Medieval Murders, which I referenced for this episode. And so his daughter interviews him in the episode about what we're talking about. And adorable. It's literally just like a family of murder, like a murder family, but like not murdering people, just researching it and talking about it.
Goals.
Like, right. I love it so much. But this murder map that was created in their kitchen for fun date night, it wasn't just a fun date night at home. It actually became like a pretty significant thing. Mm-hmm. Eisner actually founded the Medieval Murder Maps website in 2018. You can look it up. I'm referencing it for this episode. You can find it on our website. It's actually an interactive medieval murder map that identifies and locates the unnatural deaths of thousands of people throughout London, York, and Oxford. And it allows anyone who accesses it to compare the causes and patterns of urban violence in medieval England in the way that it's done for the first time ever, which in my opinion is pretty damn cool. And the fact that it's accessible to like anyone to do is even cooler. It's not just like a thing done for research purposes. It's done for whoever wants to access it.
Sure.
So I did. I looked into it. It was pretty cool. Kim, you're probably going to look it up after this. And I encourage our listeners to check it out. It's pretty sweet. And what's really interesting is what was discovered by looking into all this. So some of the research suggests that the per capita homicide rate in Oxford, specifically just Oxford, was 4 to 5 times higher than late medieval London or York, which is like pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers are hoping that the map will not only offer insight into everyday medieval life, but also help users understand the psychology of crime, which is what got my attention on this the first time I read it. And Eisner said, quote, "Crime sells, and for a number of reasons. It is something that scares us. We like to play detective. We like the mystery behind it," end quote. Amen. That's why I always want to solve unsolved mysteries that are never solved on the show, but we'll always be like, what? What happened? Nothing, because it's unsolved mysteries.
That's true.
Now, thanks to these maps, it's easier to spot trends, which is also kind of cool. And mm-hmm. it's not just in that time, but throughout history.
Right.
So for Eisner, cracking a 700-year-old case like the murder of John Ford can provide a massive and invaluable snapshot into not just crimes themselves, but medieval life, and actually help to understand the origins of our current modern criminal justice system and how things might have not changed so much in that period of time. So Eisner says, quote, "I call it a distant mirror. You don't just read it as violence. You have these little stories that are taking you on a time travel adventure," end quote.
Ooh.
I love that. I love that so much. So Eisner and a colleague named Brown, who I'll talk about in a moment, recently published statistics detailing how Oxford can be crowned a medieval murder capital, as mentioned, 4 to 5 times more than the other areas.
Nice.
Due to its specifically its population of rowdy youths.
Oh, those youths.
Oh, those rowdy youths. So I know I mentioned in the 14th century, the per capita homicide rate in Oxford was up to 5 times higher than in other cities. But 75% of the perpetrators were students between the ages of 14 and 21.
Mm.
Interesting. Quote,
isn't that nuts? Like, just lawless teenagers.
I mean, I spend a lot of time with teenagers. That tracks.
It tracks. We'll get into that in a sec, too.
Not all teenagers.
Not all, just 75% of them. Just kidding. The Oxford stats are really fascinating. It's not just because they're students, although the youth, the masculinity, all that doesn't help, says Butler, who's another researcher. Within the university, students were often split into individual colleges according to their nationality. So a lot of crime actually represents rivalries between those different groups. Hashtag West Side Story. Just kidding. But it almost was kind of like gang warfare way back in the day.
Interesting.
Yeah. And this is just one of the ways that Eisner's murder maps kind of help you understand and help scholars understand the social, political, economic, and legal realities of back in the day times. And it actually was a significant time of transition specifically for law enforcement, which was interesting. Mm. Now, this website that shows this golden age of when the city flourished, it was happening, it's just to give some context, around the time that the Black Death died down, pun intended. And it was really the success of that time. The reason why it was called the Golden Age was driven by trade and textiles. Mm-hmm. So many of the York cases actually documented feuds between artisans in the same professions that were just like up against each other for making money for their trades.
Sure.
And it involved things from like knife fights with tannery workers to fatal violence between glove makers. Just the drama is unreal.
Love it.
right. But they weren't the only ones to blame for such violence. We mentioned it a little bit before, Kim. Guess who else was mostly to blame?
Youth,
students specifically, though. So not just like young people who were studying to like be smarter.
But kids
who want to be smart just get
kids
violent
these days.
And those days too.
And those kids those days. Kids
hashtags kids those days. But yeah, their student population was by far the most in Oxford lethally violent or social professional group in any of the three cities. Apparently, which is funny, among Oxford perpetrators with a known background, this is only known, 75% were identified by the coroner as clericus, as were 72% of all of Oxford's homicide victims. Ooh. So during this period, clericus is most likely to refer to a student or member of the early university. So it wasn't just the people that were committing the murders, it was the murdered as well.
Okay.
So our friend Eisner stated that, quote, a medieval university city such as Oxford had a deadly mix of conditions. Oxford students were all male and typically aged between 14 and 21, the peak for violence and risk taking. These were young men freed from tight controls of family, parish, or guild, and thrust into an environment full of weapons with ample access to alehouses and sex workers, end quote.
Okay.
And once you add booze, it's a perfect storm. So, you know, as one of the resources, Eisner referred to translations and transcriptions from some of England's earliest legal records. And this is where I was like, where did he get all this information? I'm curious, like, to figure out who was doing all of this. When did these murders happen and why? Right. And the earliest legal records were the coroner's roll. Mm-hmm. Now, these rolls date all the way back to the 14th century and are catalogs of sudden or suspicious deaths that were deduced by a jury of local residents. And they're generally recorded in Latin, so they had to be translated when he looked them up. Mm-hmm. They included names, events, locations, and even the value of murder weapons, which is wild to me. The coroner's rolls marked one of the first times in history that government officials were making formal investigations into everyday murders and sudden deaths, which I thought was really cool. So using the rolls and maps from the Historic Towns Trust, a street atlas of 354 homicides across all three cities was created. So we have the original London map. It was published in 2018 of the murder maps, and it's been remodeled and updated to include accidents, sudden deaths, sanctuary, church cases, and deaths in prison, all of which were recorded in the coroner's rolls. So this is a quote. When a suspected murder victim was discovered in late medieval England, the coroner would be sought and the local bailiff would assemble a jury to investigate, said Eisner. A typical jury consisted of local men of good repute. Their task was to establish the course of events by hearing witnesses, assessing any evidence, and then naming a suspect. The indictments were summarized by the coroner's scribe. And that's the end of the quote. So London's remaining rolls cover nine of the years between 1300 and 1340. York's date between 1345 and 1385. And then there's a complete set for Oxford for 6 years between or before 1348, just before when the bubonic plague actually hit the city. So, and then there's also partial Oxford records that exist for 15 of the years between 1296 and 1324. So clearly it's not complete, but it's a lot. So that's kind of cool that this was able to be looked at and researched, even though it's that old. So that's where a lot of these resources come from in looking up crimes. But few coroner's rolls are complete. As we mentioned, some are missing, and even fewer have been studied and translated into something that's actually like translatable and digestible today.
Right.
There's a historian from Cambridge named Stephanie Brown. She did a lot of research with Eisner, and she actually specifically researches medieval crimes in Yorkshire and actually joined Eisner in formalizing the entire project of the medieval murder maps and added a lot of records to what he already had. And something that she had mentioned was that, quote, you have these huge bits of parchment. Each page is probably about a meter long and half a meter wide, written on vellum animal skin. And you need to be able to read this 14th century handwriting, end quote. That's a whole project in itself. That's nuts. And a lot of the times the places that are referenced don't exist anymore because it's like hundreds of years later. So like, how are you supposed to figure out where things are if these places didn't exist, which then throws a whole other wrench in the process. And it's not like they had postcodes or street numbers like we have now. So it's definitely like where Widow Severlis was living. It was like a reference of like where people lived. And it's like, then you have to go down a whole other rabbit hole to try to figure that out. So it's a lot of work to try to figure this stuff out. So props to them for doing this. So lots of things go into these reports. So there were reports that had a combination of detective work and rumor. So
nice.
Let's talk about valid reporting. Back in the day, word of mouth. We talk about that a lot. So it's a like it's a classic case of telephone and lack of documentation for a lot of this, too. And some of the juries allegedly were constructed by using strategic narratives aimed at influencing verdicts like self-defense. So they were not unbiased either, which throws in a whole other level of not being fair. And Dr. Brown, Stephanie Brown, who I mentioned previously, said, we do not have any evidence that shows, that to show juries willfully lied. But many inquests will have been a, quote, best guess based on available information. And in many instances, it is likely the jury named the right suspect. In others, it may be a case of 2 + 2 = 5.
Right.
So this is what we're working with what we have. So just for a bit of context, you know, when we're looking at the 14th century, specifically within the Oxford area, it was one of the most notable learning centers in Europe. So lots of students, hence the high level of crimes. The city had a population of about 7,000 inhabitants, with like 1,500 of them being students. So based on their research, Eisner and Brown estimated that the homicide rate in Oxford during the late medieval time was around 60 to 75 per 100,000. So that's literally like 50 times higher than current rates in current modern English cities, just to give you perspective. So when we say it's violent, it was bad, like real bad. For example, a wild night in 1298 at Oxford High Street Tavern resulted in a mass street brawl with swords and battle axes. leaving student John Burl with, quote, a mortal wound on the crown of his head, 6 inches long and in depth reaching to the brain, end quote.
Dude.
Battle axes?
I mean, I love a good battle axe. You don't bring your battle axe to, like, again,
we need to go
I go to
more.
Bars in Pioneer Square. Of course I have a battle axe on me. What do you take me for?
Was that part of your police report?
Listen, it's possible I stashed the battle axe before the police got there.
And then you said it was a car.
Exactly.
So, unfortunately, and I'm not making light of this at all, sex workers were also violently murdered instead of being paid, which is just like rude and uncool. Did anyone do anything about it?
Of course not.
No, of course not. Sex workers being murder victims doesn't just happen with the Green River Killer or anyone else of modern times.
Take your pick. Yeah,
which
seriously.
One, you know, way back in the day. Unfortunately, this is something that has happened for hundreds of years. Mm. So one might ask, what was the process like to try to hold people responsible for these acts? Which, honestly, great question. Yeah. Quote, before modern policing, victims or witnesses had a legal responsibility to alert the community to a crime by shouting and making noise. This was known as raising a hue and cry, said Dr. Stephanie Brown. I did not know this. This was interesting to me. It was often mostly women who raise hue and cry, usually reporting conflicts between men in order to keep the peace.
Hey,
who's surprised? Not it. Wonder if it worked. Probably not. So that leaves the witnesses to attempt justice, but like that doesn't guarantee their safety, which like I'm sure. I mean, if it did, don't you think everyone would have said something? So, of course, not everyone's going to speak up because there was like a lot of murders that happened because the people who went to say something got murdered. Like
it's not great,
just
guys.
Added to the murders.
Not like, great.
So a lot of people didn't speak up or say anything, right?
Yeah.
And you know, some of London's cases included, like the ones where people spoke up, weren't even murders to begin with. It was just like people doing stupid shit and someone wanting to be like, hey, don't do that, and then they get murdered. So like, guys, for example, get it together. Some of those cases include altercations that started over eel skin littering or careless public urination.
I'm sorry, eel skin littering.
Eel skin, don't litter eel skin, guys.
If you're eating your eel pie, just throw it away when you're done. Or better yet, don't throw it away in the beginning, because who wants to eat an eel pie?
No, and apparently things like that would end in homicide. What a visual, you know, like.
That's not funny, but.
But that's why we can laugh, because it's 700 years ago.
It's true.
Life in medieval urban centers could be rough, but by no means was it lawless. The community understood their rights and used the law when conflicts emerged. So before the 14th century, many violent crimes were dealt with privately without a formal trial. But after 1330, the state started to more regularly to intervene in their town's justice. So there were some new laws that mandated that all prisoners were tried and the jail had to be emptied 3 times a year. However, even then, most criminals just left because they didn't want to deal with things. So they would flee.
I mean,
and then
same.
Records, right? And then records would show that only 5 to 10% of the people who were finally tried for homicide were actually hung. So a lot of them were acquitted or transferred indefinitely to like a church prison or granted a royal pardon or died because the conditions were terrible in medieval prisons.
Right.
And if they had to clear out the prisons of like every like 3 times a year, like that's a quick turn.
That's true.
Quick turnover rate. So like, where are these people going? But not a lot of them are being actually held accountable, which is, I think, what we should really pay attention to. Mm-hmm. So anywho, Eisner said, and I'm just giving a lot of context and historical reference, so bear with me on this one. But what's interesting is that something that Eisner said, he said, I'm fascinated by the way people at the time tried to find the truth. During the 14th century, there are certain rules about what to do and how to do things. All of this is being invented in that period. The medieval criminal justice system was imperfect, but you can see it developing throughout the 14th century. that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So the coroner's roles were one of the main ways that they told these stories about what happened. He said, there are people like you and me, ordinary, run of the mill, not the great and the good, not the elite, not the rich. But for many people mentioned in the roles, it's the only time that their name was ever written down throughout history. Wow. So there's no records of them anywhere else except for in these coroner's roles. Which brings us back to this story, the initial story of the priest's assassination. And what actually happened to John Ford and why? So based on some of the research that Eisner did, all of this back-end research that we just talked about, the incident of John Ford's murder was the only time that Hugh Colne, John Strong, and John Tyndale, who were the assassins, were mentioned in writing in history. So this case and some of the other previously mentioned from the murder maps actually helps us understand violent crime patterns, which, surprise, surprise, haven't changed much in the last 700 years. And fun fact, the percentage of female suspects charged or convicted of murder in medieval London and York is actually in line with statistics from the 21st century.
Oh, no way.
Which equate to about a quarter of the crimes.
Oh, wow.
What's even more interesting is when women were suspected of a crime, they often didn't act alone, at least according to surviving records. Such was the alleged case with noblewoman Fitzpaine. Clearly, if she wasn't that a great name, it's such a good name. Fitzpaine, she brings pain.
Fitzpaine.
But clearly, if she did plan this assassination, she didn't work alone. But there's some tea to spill. Are you ready, Kim?
Spill the tea, spill the tea, spill the tea.
Spill the tea.
Spill the tea.
Okay. According to Eisner and some sleuthing done by his team, Ella Fitzpaine was mentioned in a letter from the Archbishop of Canterbury, Simon Methim. And he was writing a letter to the Bishop of Winchester.
Sure.
This letter was dated January 29th, 1332.
Okay.
It held quite the tea.
Ooh.
Or hot goss, if you will.
Spill the hot goss.
It talked about how Fitzpaine was convicted of adultery. And not just one time.
Harlot.
Allegedly. She had quite the hurrah. The letter said that she slept with quite a few people. Girl, get it.
No, so, Kim, I support this.
I actually have the letter for you.
read the letter.
And I know this is like one of your favorite things ever is to find actual like written documentation.
Oh, yeah. No, I love it. I live for this.
I could give you the summary, but I could also give you the letter. So
you could, because I want to hear the language.
Going to give you the letter. So this is a letter from the Archbishop of Canterbury. He is writing this to the Bishop of Winchester. Okay, I'm going to try to do it in a funny accent. Do I do it in a funny accent? Do I do it not in a funny accent?
Just do it straight.
Just do it normal. Okay, fine. All right. Sorry. When carrying out my metropolitical visitation of the clergy and people of the Diocese of Salisbury, it came to my ears by popular rumor and report that Ella Fitzpaine has committed adultery with knights and others, single and married, and even with clerics in holy orders. My pen does not elaborate these crimes among noble ladies. She, out of natural dignity, ought not to indulge in them. I have pronounced her guilty, partly because of her own confession expressed judicially before me, partly because of what she has denied, but in which she has entirely failed, as well as for other transparent reasons. I have decreed that for a period of 7 years, she is to travel to the Cathedral Church of Salisbury. She is to proceed in bare feet from the western entry of the church to the high altar, carrying a lighted candle of 4 pounds of wax, which she is to offer at the altar. I also decree that during the 7 years, she is prohibited from using on her head silver or gold with gems, pearls or precious stones, or ornamenting her saddle, lol, with precious stones, lol, because for women to paint themselves to appear either more red or more white is adulterous deceit. Moreover, in her chamber, she is to have a company of good, upright women, and is not to admit John Ford, rector of Oakfoot Fitzpaine, to her familiar circle, or to private conversation, but rather because of too great familiarity and dubious conversation between them, she is to remove him entirely from her company. However, impaled by a spirit of pride, more accurately, the devil, Ella Fitzpaine has both declined to perform any of those things imposed and has not given up those prohibited. She has abstained from matrimonial association with her husband, thrown aside matronly modesty, and by deed and appearance flaunted her usual insolence. I therefore instruct that she is apprehended and warned that within the space of 15 days, she is to carry out everything set out above under penalty of excommunication should she prove negligent or remiss. End quote.
Okay.
So that's a lot.
Yeah. So
in a nutshell, unfortunately, this was clearly not a time that celebrated female individuality or sexual independence.
Not at all.
So unfortunately, Fitzpaine, as mentioned in this letter, was sentenced to a punishment of public humiliation. And as was stated, every day for 7 years, she had to walk barefoot from one side of the Salisbury Cathedral to the high altar while carrying a huge lit candle. And to add insult to injury, she couldn't wear gems, silver, gold, or any makeup. And honestly, public humiliation was like a political tactic back in the day.
Yeah.
And it was huge, and it breeds very easily breeds hatred. So obviously she was pissed. And holding a grudge was the understatement of the century. So this happened before the murder happened, right? So this is predating the murder. And this was a letter found by Eisner. And so this is new information to us as far as like what exactly happened with the murder. So one other person is mentioned in the name of this letter between the Archbishop and the Bishop of Winchester. And it was the name of one of Fitzpaine's daddies. Just kidding. I just had to throw that in there. But just one of the guys she had a good time with and clearly was like close with based on how this letter like dictated, which is allegedly this particular dude never was punished for the unacceptable relationship that she had. Uncool, double standards, patriarchal and misogynistic. Ugh, gross. But such is the name of John Ford was mentioned in this letter. So that, I mean, it's not super direct, though, about what their relationship is like. It just says that they were close. And so you can use that as a way to think of that could take the game of telephone a couple different directions, right?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
And something to note that was prevalent back in the 1300s as much as it is today is motive for murder. Humiliation, revenge, and political standings being threatened can influence someone to commit murder. And add double standards to the mix where the other person who committed the same adultery that you did, but is a man, and one of the cloth even, escaped unscathed by society after you, a high society woman, are publicly humiliated for years. So, like, I too would be pissed.
Yep.
Not sure if I would hire an assassin, but hey, to each their own, you know?
That might be a step too far.
You never know. To you know, whatever floats your boat, man.
That's true.
The other person mentioned in the letter was John Ford, the victim, as we mentioned. So I guess he fucked around and found out. But let's evaluate a little deeper, because it does seem like there's some area to interpret, right? So if we look at some more context, England was ruled by Edward III at this time. The time was rife for sexual allegations and love affairs, especially with the preceding Edward II.
Sure.
People were regularly exposed to like dirty stories that were used for political motive.
Nice.
I guess not much has changed.
Yeah, it sounds part of the core right? there.
And John Ford was a priest in a village that belonged to Fitz Payne's family. Ella allegedly had an affair with him. Could that really be the reasoning why he was killed? Ooh. Also, like, how did the Archbishop of Canterbury get that hot gas of Ella and Fitz Payne? Could he have been using that as a political advantage for himself?
Possibly.
Maybe John Ford confessed to the Archbishop.
Mm-hmm.
And could the confession give him then immunity from being punished because he's confessing and he's a man? I don't know. Maybe. But this is all like hypothetical, right? We don't have any kind of like evidence to support this. It's just, sure, you know, maybe, who knows?
Sure.
But humiliation is huge, and it could be a reason that murder happened in a broad daylight assassination style with a public audience, because that could have totally been a power play.
Absolutely.
So, but was Ella a victim of a misogynistic accusation? Was she framed by the Archbishop of Canterbury? Oh. Was this making a statement, a public statement?
Maybe.
Who knows? Maybe. So glad you asked, Kim. Based on research done by Eisner, there is evidence that shows that Ella, her husband, and John Ford were actually working together in an organized crime gang.
Nice.
Fully organized crime gang in Somerset.
Nice.
Allegedly dealing with racketeering and extortion.
Wow.
Wild
1300s,
times.
Just like us.
So on March 8th, there was another document that Eisner found to support this, which is so cool. On March 8th, 1332, 3 years before the assassination, but a few months after the Archbishop's letter, there was a case that was heard by the Assize Court accusing to Robert Fitzpaine, Ella and John all together basically were holding supplies hostage in a potentially blackmail-like situation from a group of people that were of the French origin. They stole a bunch of things from a priory, destroyed the property, and only gave their stuff back to them after money was paid to them. So basically like blackmail. John Ford even got annual money paid to him from this priory. So he was already connected to them and getting money from them. Very mafia-like, very much. And it was originally owned by the French, and there was a lot of conflict between the French and the English at this time. So makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Also, conflict between church and nobility is huge. So this could have been a setup on Ella from a political angle to involve her in something like this. And what's extra nuts is that in Eisner's podcast episode, which I mentioned earlier, he talks about how murder was a sign of power relations and how there was kind of a sense of impunity, which is similar to political killings that can be seen in modern times, like in Russia and in Mexico, where the justice system is unwilling to see through justice due to power and money. So in systems where the rule of law is weak, where powerful people feel and have experienced that they can make the law themselves, they generally take power into their own hands and can commit organized political crimes and killings regardless of the year or time or context. But truthfully, I still have questions, obviously. I'm sure you have questions. What kind of questions pop up for you, Kim, with all of this?
I mean, I guess less questions for me. I find it's funny to me to think about having such similar crimes hundreds and hundreds of years ago that you could easily like pluck up and if you didn't give the date, this could be a contemporary crime. And I find that really interesting.
100%. And it's the same drama. It's the same type of politics.
Yeah.
And it's also using a woman at the center of it and a lot of blame being placed on the woman, which is something that happens a lot throughout history. So it really makes me wonder about the angle of like, was she framed?
Right.
Was this something that had deeper relations between the Fitzpaine family and the entire church vicinity of people? Like, was something else going on and she just didn't fall into line with what social expectations were of women at the time?
Yeah.
And because she was the said harlot, blame it on the harlot. You know,
sure.
Maybe she was like best friends with this guy and hung out with him all the time. But maybe it wasn't a sexual angle. Maybe it was just like her really close bud.
Sure.
And maybe to teach her a lesson, someone else hired these dudes to kill him and put it on her, saying she got punished for other deeds and he didn't. Like, there's so many angles you could just hypothesize. And like,
well, and I think that's what makes it hard is, I mean, we can sit here and speculate, but without some of those details, it becomes, I mean, there's so many different avenues you could say it could have been this, it could have been this. And, sure. And again, I feel like there's a lot of contemporary crimes where I feel very similarly, that we're just lacking that key piece or those key pieces of evidence that will help kind of give us the full picture.
For sure.
And that trying to fill in some of those blanks is what's led to people being wrongfully accused and wrongfully imprisoned, too.
Totally. I just find it so fascinating that this all this information was dug up like 700 years later.
No, and that's amazing.
Two pieces of like actual documented evidence were brought up to be like, well, actually, no, this could have been part of the reason why. And kind of, it's funny, some of the articles that I read said that the case was solved, which I don't know if I agree with it being solved, because it doesn't feel fully solved to me.
I feel like you could say it was closed, and that's different than solved.
I agree. I would say that the case was closed in the sense of, yeah, there was some shady shit and some people involved, and it was these people. But like, we don't know if those questions will ever be answered. This is already more information than anyone knew up until this point.
Sure.
And like, we're not going to necessarily know, was the murder ever tied directly, did she actually like, was she actually involved?
Right. Yeah.
Also, if she was she ever held accountable for anything outside of the, you know, adultery punishment that she had, which like is so messed up.
Yeah.
But so, you know, some questions will never be answered, but it is pretty cool that some of these concepts were brought to the table 700 years later.
Yeah.
After this case went coldish by Manuel Eisner and his team, and you know how there is evidence that we are not the only ones intrigued by murder maps. There's more of us out there.
I got two books on murder maps.
I love that. But that's the story of a cold case reopened 700 years later with some murder maps and some digging.
Nice.
And that's the story of the murder map and the solved 700-year-old case.
Love it.
And this brings us to Creepy Critics Corner. Creepy Critics Corner. Kim, what you been watching?
I got a couple things I've been watching. I did go and see Lisa Frankenstein, which is really fun.
Nice.
It's kind of delightful. Those of you who are unfamiliar, Lisa Frankenstein, set in the 80s, and it's about a girl, and she's kind of the outcast, and her dad has remarried, and she's struggling, and she's the weird kid, and she likes to go to the cemetery to visit the grave of this guy, just because she's kind of intrigued by him. And then one night, you know, shenanigans happen, and wouldn't you know it, dead guy comes back to life, and they kind of become buddies. But dead guy is going to be dead, and sometimes their parts are rotten off, and they need to get new parts. And what are you supposed to do? Where do you get new parts from, Gabby?
From other people.
From other people. And shenanigans ensue. It's fun. It's a fun watch. I will say, this is the PG-13 version. It is very obvious after watching it that this was not originally a PG-13 movie.
Oh.
And I would be real interested to see, like, either a director's cut or you know, what the more the rated R cut, the unrated cut is. But it's really fun. And what is kind of cool too, Zelda Williams is the director. Zelda Williams, who is daughter of Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
And it's Diablo Cody who wrote the screenplay. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then I watched a movie called Somewhere Quiet. And this one was really intriguing. Very much a psychological horror film. It's about a woman who recently had been gotten away from abductors. She'd been missing for, I think it was 6 months.
Dang.
And she'd been kidnapped and held captive and is kind of trying to deal with that trauma. And her husband takes her to this cabin out in the mountains that belongs to his family. And his cousin is out there. And stuff seems weird. But the whole time, and this is, I love how they use this. And I don't think the script is always 100% successful, but I think the performances are all really, really good. Jennifer Kim, who plays Meg, is fantastic. Kind of walking that line of what's happening in her head and what's happening in reality. And is she losing it? Is she experiencing some kind of severe post-traumatic stress disorder or these crazy things really happening? And then Maren Ireland, who plays the cousin, is also just really, really good. The women in this movie really shine. And it is directed by Olivia West Lloyd and written by her. So women directed, women written,
yay,
women produced, focusing on women. But I thought it was really, really interesting. And the acting is spectacular and just really playing with that unreliable narrator. What's actually happening, what's in her head. And I thought it was a really, really interesting little film. So, yeah, those are,
that sounds really good.
Too worth checking out, in my opinion.
All right. I have to add it to my list of things I need to check out. Cause I fully wait too long to check literally anything out. And don't realize that like 5 years have gone by and now I'm seeing a movie that came out in 2019, thought it came out like last year, but what is time?
What is time?
What is time? But that's actually what happened to me this last week is I watched a movie on the plane with Terrence. He started it and then we were both like, okay, well, we'll watch on our own screens, but we'll start it at the same time. So it's like we're watching it together. And it was The Joker. Joker. With Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
And I had never seen it, but I'd always wanted to. And we started listening to, this is kind of like a double, the two things I've been listening to but are related. Newcomers, the podcast with Lauren Lapkus and Nicole Byer. I've talked about this podcast before. They cover different worlds of movies. They did Star Wars. They did Lord of the Rings. They're doing all the Batman movies right now. And Terrence loves Batman. And so we started listening to one of the episodes, but it's making me want to watch more Batman movies because I'm listening to them talk about it and their reactions are just like my favorite thing in the world. Yeah. And it makes me want to watch things that they talk about more. But that was kind of I haven't listened to the Joker one yet. I don't know if they're doing Joker or not, but it got me thinking and being more open-minded to watch Joker is the point. Yeah. And so I was intrigued. We watched it. Wow, that movie is so sad.
I'm not a fan myself. But
rough. I mean, I can appreciate it for the acting that Joaquin Phoenix did, and like he got so skinny for that movie and like just the mental health challenges of that film are hard to watch.
Yep.
But I can appreciate it for what it is. I'm glad I saw it because I hadn't literally thought it came out last year. I was like, is this the one with Lady Gaga? And Terrence was like, no, that one hasn't even come out yet. I was just like, I don't know. I don't know things. I don't pay attention. I have you and him to like keep me in check with that kind of stuff. But I did watch that. And I got really excited that there is a new season of the show Ghosts.
Oh, yeah.
On CBS with our friend Betsy Sidaro. Mm-hmm. She's back for season 3.
She is.
And she's so sassy. It's so good in there. Her hitting on like the big Viking guy is like my favorite thing ever as a caller a ghost. It's very funny. But yeah, that's what I've been watching. And then also just doing research for this episode that we just talked about and reading for school, which I don't need to get into. Also, trash TV. Love is Blind is
trash
TV.
It's your favorite.
Love is Blind makes me want to like break my TV and throw it out a window. Like it's such a trash fire. That show is just ridiculous and everyone in it is dumb. like, I don't know if I can even continue to watch it. It's that bad. So if I say that, you know, that means something. that's what I've been watching. Oh, wait, there's one more thing I have to share. I've been meaning to tell you about it. I'm so sorry. I forgot to mention it. Okay, so speaking of trash TV, on the plane on the way to Florida, I found a Say Yes to the Dress with Tan from Queer Eye. Does Say Yes to the Dress in London. And so I, of course, had to watch it because what a great collab right there. And one of the episodes has a woman who is getting married and trying to find her wedding dress to marry a ghost. And the looks on the faces of Tan and the girls trying to help her find a dress.
Lord.
I looked her up. I found it. I sent it to you.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That's what I sent you.
You did.
I was losing it laughing and like could not. Like, it just brought me back to our episode of So I Married a Ghost. But it's a different person. It's not the same one.
It's a lot of people marrying ghosts out there.
But I'm so glad that she got on Say Yes to the Dress, because really a whole new audience now, you know? But wow, what just grade A chef's kiss entertainment for trash TV.
It's a thing that happens.
Highly recommend. Anyway, that's what I've been watching. What a random plethora of things. But having said that, thank you for listening. Thank you guys for understanding our extra week break that was in there. And thank you to Max, our editor, yes, for doing such a wonderful job with our editing. So thank you, Max Holchek, for being editor extraordinaire. And thank you guys for listening. If you want to find us on social medias, we are Ghoulish Tendencies on the Instagrams, on the Facebook, on all the things. And we also have a Patreon. If you like what we do and you want to financially contribute, you are welcome to. There is some extra perks on there for you, as well as, you know, if you can't financially contribute, head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify to leave a rating and a review. So thank you so much for listening. And having said that,
stay